Code Talker, Disc 4.
Chapter 19. Do you have a Navajo? From Bougainville, the other code talkers and I went back to Hawaii. There were more changes in our code to make up, learn, and share. Words had to be added for new weapons, military terms, and situations of war. Armored tracers, napalm. Each had to have its equivalent in Navajo. Among those new words was one that we'd grown to know far too well. Abidza'a. That means, pick 'em off. It was our code word for sniper. Just saying it made me want to duck my head down, remembering my recent experience on Bougainville. Our Navajo secret code that had begun with a vocabulary of only 265 words was now almost twice that size. Code talkers were in such demand that recruiters were having a hard time finding enough qualified Navajos. Although many commanders had been hesitant at first about trusting Navajos with their most crucial messages, they'd learned to depend on us. Situations in the field had shown our worth. For example, there was a time back on Bougainville when we Marines took a crucial enemy position quicker than anyone expected. Right after our first squad occupied that spot, shells began to hit all around us. Those shells were from our own artillery. This was back before that particular captain in charge was really confident about having an Indian on the radio. I was with them, but they had me carrying a rifle, not a radio. The radio man at the front wasn't a Navajo, but a white guy named McAdams. McAdams cranked up his set and radioed back, "We are Americans. Stop the artillery." But those shells just kept on coming. They'd gotten so many phony messages sent by Japanese soldiers who spoke perfect English that they thought it was just an enemy trick. McAdams kept begging them to quit shooting at us, but the shells just kept whistling in. Finally, a message was sent back to McAdams from the artillery. "Do you have a Navajo?" "Somebody get Begay up here," the captain yelled. "On the double." I came running, Smitty right behind me. I handed him my rifle, grabbed hold of the microphone, and started talking code. I no longer remember exactly what I said, but a minute later the shelling stopped. From then on, that captain was sold on us code talkers. When Marine Corps headquarters asked for recommendations from their generals in the field about the code talker program, the responses were unanimous. "We need more code talkers now," they said. Some of the things those generals wrote made me feel so good that I almost laughed out loud. Remember, grandchildren, like so many other Navajos, I had grown up hearing only criticism and hard words from the Biliganas about our people. We Navajos were stupid, we were lazy, we couldn't be taught anything. We could never be as good as any white man. To hear what was now being said truly made the sun shine in my heart. The Navajos have proved to be excellent Marines, intelligent, industrious, easily taught to send and receive by key, and excellent in the field. That's what the commanding general of the 6th Marine Division put in his official report. It was recommended that every signal company have 8 code talkers. Code talkers should be in every regiment and battalion, from artillery and anti-tank battalions to engineer regiments and scout companies. Each Marine Division was expected to have at least 100 code talkers. On Hawaii, I heard some of what happened in the campaign to take the far end of New Britain Island so that Rabaul could be under attack from both sides. In the landing at Cape Gloucester and the fighting afterward, our code talkers did a lot. The Navajos on New Britain Island not only sent messages by radio and telephone, sometimes they even carried them by hand, running from one position to another. It was dangerous work, for not only was there the danger of enemy fire, but also the chance that another Marine might mistake a Navajo for an enemy. I was glad that I'd had Smitty and Georgia Boy watching my back on Bougainville. Otherwise, what happened to Alex Williams on New Britain Island could have happened to me. "It was night," Alex said to the group of us sharing stories as we sat looking at the ocean one evening. "There was a heavy rainstorm. The Japanese were attacking, and I had to get a message to 2nd Battalion. Just then, though, wouldn't you know it, my radio went out. So I had to take the message to them on foot," Alex continued. "That wasn't so bad, but on my way back I got lost. I was crawling around in the dark, trying to find my way, when I ran into another Marine. He stared wide-eyed at my face. "Password," he growled. The password that night was lame duck, so I said it. But he still thought I was a phony. "You blankety-blank son of a gun," he snarled. Then he stuck me right in the back with a bayonet. Before it could sink in, I rolled headfirst into a foxhole. Luckily, I landed on top of Sergeant Curtis, followed close after by that bayonet-wielding jarhead thirsty for my blood. "What the hell is this?" Sergeant Curtis growled. "This guy thinks I'm Japanese," I said. I was glad that Sergeant Curtis was a big man, because I was able to keep him between me and that other Marine. Alex shook his head as he reached to rub his shoulder blade where that bayonet had grazed him. Sergeant Curtis told the guy I was all right, but I still spent the rest of the night in that foxhole. At times, while I was back in Hawaii, I felt as if the things around me weren't real. It was too quiet and beautiful. There were no guns being fired, no shells exploding around me, no muddy foxholes. I was with other Navajos, and we were speaking our sacred language together. I should have been happy, but instead it made me feel ill at ease. I found myself wondering what was happening to Georgia Boy and Smitty. Because they weren't Navajos, they had not been sent to Hawaii as I had been. But I no longer thought of them as Bilagana strangers. They were friends and fellow Marines, and I wished they could have enjoyed some of the beauty and peace that was around me at Pearl. Another of the hard things about being in a war, grandchildren, is that although there are times of quiet when the fighting has stopped, you know you will soon be fighting again. Those quiet times give you the chance to think about what has happened. Some of it you would rather not think about, as you remember the pain and the sorrow. You also have time to worry about what will happen when you go into battle again. I am sure that is why so many Marines drank heavily when they were in the midst of those quiet times. When they were drunk, they no longer could think of those things. Some of our Navajo co-talkers joined in that heavy drinking. After the war, they still kept on with that drinking to try to keep that terrible world of war out of their minds. Never think that war is a good thing, grandchildren. Though it may be necessary at times to defend our people, war is a sickness that must be cured. War is a time out of balance. When it is truly over, we must work to restore peace and sacred harmony once again. I was not one of those who tried to forget through drinking, although I was tempted. One or two beers, or sometimes just a cold bottle of Coca-Cola, was enough for me. What helped me through those times of uncertainty were thoughts of my home and family. It comforted me to know that my family was praying for me during those times. I felt close to them when I rose each morning and used corn pollen at dawn. In that way, even when I was sad and afraid, I kept it in mind that the holy people wouldn't forget me. Being a Navajo and keeping to our Navajo way helped me survive not just the war, but all those times of quiet and anxious waiting that were not yet peace.